Thank you so much. It is really an honor to be here today. I want to express my appreciation to the director and to all of the Menzikong physicians and staff in all of the work that they're doing, and especially the support that they have provided for our Tukdan project, which I'll mention in just a few minutes. So what I thought I would do is spend the first part of this talk describing a little bit about the focus of the work that we're doing now in our center. We are focused on the topic of well-being. And we use well-being rather than happiness because the idea isn't really to be happy all the time. If a sad event or something tragic occurred, it would not be appropriate to be happy in that moment. I've seen His Holiness the Dalai Lama cry in response to a description of a tragedy. And so at that moment, there is an appropriate expression of sadness. And so it's possible to be sad and to have very high levels of well-being at the same time. And so that's why we prefer the term well-being. Another term that we also use is flourishing. And what we believe is that every human being, as His Holiness says, every human being is the same. We're all built in the same way. And every human being has the capacity to flourish. And we would even go a little further, and we would say that every human being has the right to flourish and also has all of the necessary constituents, the necessary components, or the underlying mechanisms that enable a person to flourish or to have well-being. So the reason why we're so interested in well-being is because we believe that well-being is best regarded as a skill. It can be trained. And so a person is not necessarily stuck at the level that she or he may experience. And this is one of the great insights that we've gleaned from our study of Buddhism, and the importance of training the mind in the Buddhist framework. And this is an area where His Holiness has taught us so much, and emphasized the importance of training the mind. And so what we have found quite remarkably is that when a person trains their mind, their well-being improves and their brain changes. And not just the brain, but many other things in their mind and body also change. The two great drivers of plasticity, or the two great mechanisms of plasticity, are neuroplasticity, which is changes that can occur in the brain, and the equivalent of neuroplasticity in the realm of genomics, and that we call epigenetics. Epigenetics is the science of how our genes are regulated. So all of us are born with a sequence of base pairs that constitute our DNA. And for the most part, that will not change over the course of your lifetime. But what will change is the extent to which any gene is turned on or turned off. Our genes are highly dynamic, and they can switch on and off quite rapidly and in response to events in our environment, in response to our emotions, our demeanor, And they also play a very important role in understanding how our minds are connected to our health, because changes in epigenetics can be associated with increased vulnerability to certain kinds of physical disorders that impact our health. So in our work on well-being, we have formulated a framework for understanding the key pillars or the key components of well-being. So what are these four key pillars? I will go through them. The first pillar we call awareness. Awareness is where mindfulness would be. Awareness is where attention would be. And our awareness is key to so much of what we do. So let me give you some examples. We know that we can voluntarily regulate our attention. So if I asked you to please pay attention to this glass of water, all of you would, in one way or another, to some extent, be able to focus your attention on this glass of water. Or if I asked you to attend to the sensations in your right foot right now, probably some of you can bring your attention to that part of your body. And it turns out that this quality of awareness, our capacity to regulate our attention, can indeed be trained. There was a very famous scientific experiment that was published about 10 years ago now that is really a critical experiment in this area. And let me share with you what was done. It involved about 3,500 people in different parts of the world. And it took advantage of the fact that many people these days, most people, carry around a smartphone. And so participants were asked their permission to text them at different points throughout a day. And they're asked three questions. The first question is, what are you doing right now? And they checked off from a list of activities what they were doing. Could be eating, it could be doing your washing the dishes, it could be working, whatever it might be. You checked off what you're doing. Second question, where is your mind right now? Right at this moment, where is your mind? Is it focused on what you're doing, or is it focused elsewhere? And the third question that participants were asked is, right at this moment, how happy or unhappy are you right now? And they're asked to rate on a slider scale how happy or unhappy they were. So here's the finding from this study. The average person spends 47% of her or his waking life not paying attention to what they're doing. 47% of the time. So if they were supposedly working, almost half the time, their mind was wandering. It was lost. They weren't paying attention to what they're doing. And when they were not paying attention to what they were doing, they reported that they were significantly less happy. Even if what they were doing was mundane, and what we say pedestrian, ordinary activity like washing the dishes or doing your laundry. So even those mundane activities, if your mind is wandering, you are less happy when you're doing it. And the title of this scientific paper is "A Wandering Mind is an Unhappy Mind." A wandering mind is an unhappy mind. Really important. And so we know that simple practices, for example, of shamatha meditation, can help cultivate this quality of awareness and decrease the likelihood that a person becomes distracted. So the second pillar of well-being we call connection. And connection is about the qualities that are important for healthy social relationships. His Holiness reminds us that we are all social animals. And one of the things that social animals do is they form connections with other people. And qualities like appreciation, gratitude, kindness, compassion are all part of this pillar of connection. Now, one of the really exciting developments in scientific research over the last 10 years has been the discovery that we all come into the world with a propensity or a predisposition toward kindness and toward what we would say is pro-social behavior, altruism. How do we know that? Well, if we expose a six-month-old baby to a scenario like puppets who are playing with each other, and sometimes they're playing in a warm-hearted way, and other times they are behaving in a selfish way, a six-month-old baby strongly prefers warm-hearted. In fact, in a recent study with a very large group of six-month-old infants, 100% of infants show this preference. So it's not just a small, statistically significant difference. It's huge. Virtually every infant shows this. And this is really important because it meshes, it confirms something found in the Buddhist tradition, which is this notion of innate basic goodness, that all human beings are born with Buddha nature. We all have the seeds of kindness within us, and scientific research strongly confirms that this is true. So when we meditate on compassion, we're not trying to create a novel emotion, but rather we're familiarizing ourselves with the very nature of our own mind, because compassion and kindness are at the core of what it is to be human. However, we think of kindness and compassion in a way that's very similar to the way other scientists think about language. Every human being comes into the world with a biological capacity for language. But we know that in order for that capacity to be expressed, it needs to be nurtured. And so a child who is not raised in a normal linguistic community will not develop normal language. And similarly, a child who doesn't receive love and kindness from his caregivers will not develop these qualities normally. And you know, His Holiness reminds us that the seeds of compassion are often in the relationship between a child and his mother. Excuse me. That a mother provides for the child, provides kindness and care for the child, and represents this early seed of compassion. So this is the second pillar. I've told you about awareness. I've told you about connection. The third pillar we call insight. And insight is a curiosity-driven knowledge of the self. And the self is a narrative. A narrative that we all construct about who we are. And this is the scientific equivalent of emptiness, or shunyata. And it's having this insight into the nature of the self and the insubstantiality of the self and the recognition that what we call the self is simply a constellation of thoughts and beliefs, and it's always changing. And this recognition helps to loosen the constraints that this narrative imposes and is very important for our well-being. And research shows that it's not so much about changing the narrative that is important, but it is changing our relationship to this narrative so that we can see the narrative for what it is, which is really a constellation of thoughts. So this is the third pillar of well-being. The fourth pillar of well-being we call purpose. And purpose is about identifying our sense of direction in life. And it is not so much about finding something more meaningful and purposeful to do, but how can we find meaning and purpose in that which we are already doing, including in the regular activities of our daily life, like in the United States, we have to take out our garbage and put it in a can on the street, or cleaning the house, or washing your dishes. Can those simple activities be associated deeply with your sense of purpose? And the answer is yes, of course they can, but it requires a shift in mindset. And so we can invoke the intention that I'm cleaning the house for the benefit of others, so that when others in the family and guests come in the house, they will feel more comfortable. So serving others in this way, and this is really an extension of compassion, is so important in cultivating this sense of purpose. So these are the four pillars of well-being, and just to review them once more: awareness, connection, insight, and purpose. Each of these four pillars has different brain states associated with them that we and other scientists have characterized. And we know that each of these four pillars of well-being shows plasticity. That is, each of them can be trained. And we know that when we train them, we can enhance our well-being. And we have developed an app called the Healthy Minds Program, where you can learn some of the science and meditation practices for each of these four pillars of well-being. And the app is freely available throughout the world. Unfortunately, it's only available in English, but if you are an English speaker and understand it, you can download it and check it out. So it's available all over the world on both Android and Apple devices. So I want to now pivot to our work on Thukdam, since I was asked to say a few words about this. We began this project now many years ago at the request of His Holiness. His Holiness made the request that we investigate Thukdam, and I believe that one of his interests, His Holiness's interest in studying Thukdam, is because this represents a real challenge to Western science, because the suggestion in the traditional Tibetan texts is that there is a subtle quality of awareness that is still present even after the conventional Western definition of death, after the heart has stopped beating, after the breathing has stopped. There is said to be this subtle quality of awareness, this clear light stage that is still present. And of course, if this is confirmed by modern scientific methods, it will be a very, very important discovery and will really have tremendous implications for many different areas of science. And so over the course of the last roughly 10 or 12 years, we've had equipment here in India, both here in the Dharamsala area as well as in the south in Badakute, where there are the large monasteries, to be available to investigate these cases of Thukdam. And so far we have studied more than 20 cases. And there is not that much that we can say at this point, but there is one finding which seems to be quite consistent, and that is that the body of a practitioner in Thukdam does not decompose in the same way that a body of a normal person who is not in Thukdam does. And so we've had cases up to 38 days in Thukdam where the body remains quite preserved, fresh, without any smell, and with the skin still very pliable and no rigor mortis. So this is extremely unusual, and we believe that when we publish these initial findings on the slowed rate of decomposition, it will really be an important both challenge and opportunity for the mainstream scientific community. In the West, when we think about death from a biomedical perspective, a traditional biomedical perspective, we think of it almost like in a binary way, like an on-off switch. There's a moment that you're alive and the next moment you're dead. Well, even from a strictly materialist perspective, biological systems don't work in this kind of binary way. They're much more graded, much more gradual. And so it's very unlikely that everything shuts down instantaneously at the same time. It's much more likely that different aspects of our body and mind and brain die at different rates. And so this is one of the several contributions that we believe the Thukdam project will make. One of the decisions that we've made over the last several days in meetings that we've had here at Menzikon with all of the teams that are working on the Thupdam project, including colleagues in Russia who are working on this, as well as the Menzikon staff, and also some scientists that we've recruited to collaborate with us from NIMHANS, which is the National Institute of Mental Health and Neuroscience in Bangalore, which is one of the top Indian neuroscience institutes. What we have decided to do is to begin a major longitudinal study of practitioners in the monasteries in the south who are 75 years and older. And we will follow them through their passing and then hopefully obtain their consent while they are still alive to enable us to monitor them as they die. And some of them will go into Thupdam and some of them will not. And that is going to be itself a really interesting and important question. Can any of the measures that we take of brain activity while a practitioner is still alive predict whether he will go into Thupdam when he dies? We do not know the answer to that. When I asked His Holiness on one occasion, I said, "Your Holiness, can you predict whether a particular person will or will not go into Thupdam when they die?" He thought about it for a little bit, and he said, "No, he doesn't think so. He doesn't think he can predict." So it will be interesting to see if any of these scientific measurements can predict. We don't know. At the very least, they will provide some important baseline information for us and will enable us to ideally be able to measure these practitioners right after they meet the conventional Western definition of death. The earliest we've been able to get to a case of Thupdam is 26 hours after a practitioner has died. So we've missed the first full day. And there is some reason to believe that that first 24-hour period is going to be very, very important for scientific reasons. And so we want to be able to do the measurements that we do immediately after a person passes. And if we recruit participants while they're still alive and obtain their consent, I think will increase the likelihood that we can begin recording immediately. So this is one of our longer term goals. We'll also be hiring a postdoctoral scientist from NIMHANS to be on the ground managing this project. Up until now, we have not had a full-time scientist who is monitoring and supervising the project, and it will be very, very good for us to have that. And so through our collaboration with the Laboratory for the Study of the Neuroscience of Consciousness at NIMHANS, we will have a postdoc who will be the project manager for the Thupdam project. They'll be paid full-time to do this, and they'll be doing these studies in the south of India. So that is a synopsis of where we are with the Thupdam project, and maybe I'll stop here for the moment, and we'll be very happy to answer any questions. So thank you all so much.